there was a publication, the AMA, called Getting Rid of Stupid Stuff. And it was basically a mirror image of this project that we're trying to lead. And
that was Dr. Jesse Roski, hospitalist and medical director for clinical optimization at CenterCare. And this is a podcast series for clinical partners and nurses and care team members about what Dr. Roski and her team are doing to help improve the daily work.
I've been thinking a lot about systems and how we as individual clinicians can never perform as well as we could when we're in part of highly functional teams, and how we can get better outcomes for our individual patients and for our system overall when we're willing to be part of that team instead of having this preconceived notion that we can alone do it. You know, we have to be not the captains of the ship, but part of the pit crew, as Dr. Atul Gawande said in one of my favorite TED Talks, the How to Heal Medicine TED Talk. But out of the HRO work, there was this article that went around. It's from 2003. Mm-hmm. People call it the Tucker article. That's the author. And it's the California Management Review, with a very intriguing title, which is Why Hospitals Don't Learn from Failures.
Provocative.
And that's jarring to consider, because I mean, we all consider ourselves the pinnacle of our professional efforts, and I think we'd like to think we're learning from our failures, but the truth is, as a system, we don't learn from failures as well as we wish we did.
I mean, that's really what Tucker found in his research, right? I'm quoting from the research now that, quote, nurses encounter nearly one system failure every hour. That's 6.5 per 8-hour shift. Effectively removing, it says, one in every 15 nurses from patient care duties just to deal with failures each day.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not a nurse living that reality, that's hard to imagine.
There's this part of the article that really resonated with me where they talk about imagining a nurse. Some of this is kind of a paraphrase or riff off what they had, but that on a single shift, the nurse just runs out of linens all the time, and they're just sick of it, and they bring it up to their manager. Like, this is not going well. I always have to track down linens from somewhere else. And then they find out in the morning that there's no morning wait, and there's no I's and O's. They empty the Foley catheter and didn't put the urine output in. And instead of, like, maybe just calling the nurse and figuring out and doing the wait themselves, they pointed out that something was missed and this was a concern. They're busy dealing with that, and then somehow a patient who's NPO on their list ends up getting a snack in the morning, and oh no, now we have a big issue. And they are willing to say, you know, I made a mistake, but I really don't think this is on me as an individual. This is on the system. I'm too busy getting linens to do the work I'm supposed to be doing as an RN. And then key to this initial project we have here, imagine the patient who's NPO is supposed to be getting a colonoscopy, and they say, you know, part of your work today is the patient's going to get this colonoscopy, you have to sign the consent form. And they say, wait a minute, what exactly am I signing? And is this in the scope of my practice? And should I be doing? And at this point, you're just really annoyed at this person. Like, just hearing this story, or like, this person is, they are a disruptive troublemaker. They need to just do their job and stop expressing all the frustrations we all have that we all just deal with every day. Mm-hmm. And the optimal nurse is somebody who can just problem solve and figure this stuff out. But that is why we fail, because we are not willing to look at the small failures and try to figure out how we can embed second order problem solving to fix those small failures so they don't just continue to replicate and wear us down. And the Tucker article just has some brilliant insights into the idea that when those pebbles persist and they stick in your shoe and you encounter them day after day after day, the first day you might feel gratified in yourself that you were able to solve the problem. But in the end, the fact that the system is not improving and failing just wears you down. And it's the negative driver on our resiliency, that this is what we have to do in order to get the work done, is to just be an autonomous problem solver and fix it every single day. Huh. And that's not how we make a system that learns from itself, and it's not how we make a highly reliable organization.
No, I would imagine not. Let's bring in your dyad partner, Chelsea Bakken. Chelsea, welcome.
Sure.
You are the Senior Director of Performance Improvement, and I know because you told me previously that you started out in psychology, became a floor nurse inspired by your mom, mm-hmm. who is also an RN, and then moved into patient safety and quality.
Yep, that's my background.
Now, Dr. Roski just mentioned second-order problem solving. Can you give us a sense from an improvement science perspective? What is first order problem solving and what is second order problem solving?
So the way that I think of first order and second order is first order is really at the front line, and it's the ability to solve problems on our own in the clinical environment, if I'm being specific to healthcare, using simple skills that can be taught.
So then if first order problem solving is solving the problem directly in front of you for the moment that I have to solve it because I've got other things to get done, what is second order problem solving in healthcare?
I think of it as supported problem solving, bringing in some of the improvement science that Jesse referenced at the beginning of the podcast, using some expert level skill sets in a team-based approach to get us to where we want to be.
Okay, so how do you make this work real? What is essential to improvement?
I think we need to just consider the wisdom and the daily trials of the people on the front lines. And my goal with clinical optimization was like, you know, if we just ask the people who are stuck on the front line trying to swim upstream against a system that has some flaws, I bet they'd have some really good ideas for things that can make some really good efficiencies and can make things better.
And that makes sense. So what did you two do? How did you actually put this into action?
We said, well, we had to start small, you know, if we're going to try to do this. And we thought it's a test of change, you know, buzzword in improvement science. We'll do a test of change in a circumscribed area with a set number of staff. And we'd tackle Med 2 and we'd figure out, you know, what kind of ideas did they have about where these little pebbles in their shoes were. And we specifically wanted things that negatively impacted their efficiency and were potential patient safety issues. We just went in and started asking questions and observing and doing surveys and trying to learn from the people who were doing the daily work every day and doing the daily problem solving every day.
Now, this was in the fall of 2021, as I recall, and you told me that you brought in Dr. Sarah Carter, a trusted colleague of yours, to help you kick it off. Before we bring in Dr. Carter, for those of you who don't know, she's a hospitalist who is double boarded in internal medicine and pediatrics and chairs the hospital peer review committee. Now, Dr. Roski, when the two of you went to the staff of Med 2, what did you hear?
Too many good ideas. the biggest challenge of this project is the number of good ideas that were brought forward. We decided before we went in that we'd have to find a way to collate and organize them, but then also to apply a decision matrix about how we proceed with these individual things. So some of it was we just offered the chance that they could share the concern, have the psychological safety to say, we're asking you to tell me what's wrong. We are going to you and looking to your expertise. Please speak up. It's not punitive. There won't be punishment or somebody looking down on you as somebody who's a noisy troublemaker. We're asking you to point out the flaws. And then we got just a long list of things that you would call daily problem solving that really then it's going to the people responsible for the running of the unit leaders, to say, this is things our frontline staff are able to identify and we need to pay attention to them, hear their voice, try to fix those things, and then close the loop of communication so they know that their ideas were heard. That's the second challenge I think we find is that it's not always quick to fix issues. And so somebody brings something up and then I think it probably feels like they're screaming into the void. You know, it's like, well, I told you that. And then I never heard another thing. Nobody's doing anything about it. When in the background, it's like, it's the duck paddling under the water, right? Everybody's trying really hard to find a solution. The other category of problems that we identified were things that were bigger. So something that, oh, this doesn't just affect Med 2. Somebody stumbled onto something here that is really pretty impactful across the organization. And it's going to take more stakeholders and more people to fix it. And that's where we decided we would have a work group within clinical optimization that Dr. Carter would lead with Sue Kolesz supporting her and her knowledge of improvement science. And they'd bring together the stakeholders and one by one try to knock off those bigger good ideas. And we have 13 of them, like 13 projects that we could just tackle one at a time. Huh. But we chose consents first. And I'm wondering, Dr. Carter, can you tell us a little bit about I reflect back on when we chose consent, and I really wanted you to feel passionate and happy about the project you were tackling. And you took it on, and I was like, oh boy. I was like, this is very ambitious. But we chose it, and I think you were so incredibly right. And I would like you to tell us a little bit about why you chose consent as the first work group project.
So first and most important, obviously, was patient safety. And then, as you were referring to, is, you know, the efficiency of the nursing workflow throughout their day and the reduction of the use of resources and rework. And then also to make sure that those providers that are doing procedures do have an understanding of, you know, what is best practice when it comes to the risk management of informed consent. And then finally is the issue of making sure that we're compliant with the policies and regulatory obligations. And with the patient safety, we owe patients that true informed consent process, not just to be compliant with the policies and regulatory, but as a ethical responsibility to respect patient autonomy.
So with informed consent, what did it look like before, and what do you hope it's going to look like after you have improved this process?
So prior to our work on this process, each area of procedures had their own process, and each one had a different way of approaching who obtained the consent and when it was signed and where it was signed and who was signing it. And so we looked at four separate areas and tried to align all four areas such that they have a very similar process for the nurses to be able to know when the patient has been spoken to by the proceduralist so that true informed consent has been obtained. That consent form has been filled out, and then the patient is able to sign, and the nurse is signing as a witness to the patient versus the nurse feeling as though they're responsible for obtaining the informed consent. And that process has gone live. We have a few, you know, processes that we're working on to make sure that it's streamlined, but for the majority, it has been implemented and is working well.
That's great. And this is the shift from compliance, so to speak, to true informed consent that you mentioned earlier.
Correct.
And I think one of the stories that motivated us all to take this on as one of the first ones was there were times that we uncovered where a floor nurse was being asked to call the surrogate decision maker, so someone had a guardian or something, and go through the consent form with them and then obtain that consent verbally. And it really bumped up into a very gray area of they are supposed to be witnessing the consent conversation that takes place and witnessing the signature, acknowledging that the consent conversation took place. But the consent conversation takes place between the proceduralist and the surrogate decision maker. And a nurse who was brave enough to speak up said, you know, there are times that I think I'm basically the one having the consent conversation. And that's where it really was. We need a better process to make sure that we are meeting our obligations for our patients. And I think there have been a few growing pains. The new process is really exciting. Of course, nothing's perfect. And there this will always bump into the tension of efficiency as we move through procedures. Like there has to be turnover time and we have to get through a certain amount of work. And the time of our proceduralist and our anesthesiologist is very, very valuable. So we bump into that concern. And the people who run the pre-procedure spaces are under that constant pressure. But we have to make sure we can serve our obligations to both spaces. Like we have to make an efficient system, and we can't compromise patient safety and true informed consent.
I think about, you know, in your story, the nurse who spoke up and said, you know, I don't think this is how it actually should work. And that takes me back to Chelsea Bakken for a moment. So what you all are trying to encourage, it sounds like, is the noisy complainer, as it was spoken of in the Tucker research years ago. So in your background, how do you encourage the noisy complainer everywhere throughout CentraCare?
I think this project is one perfect example of that. And if we can spread this, it is bringing problems to the forefront, right? That's the basis of improvement. We address problems, we don't cover them up. That also empowers individuals to continue to do that. It engages them. But more than that, I think it energizes them, right? They get a chance to share their perspective, speak up, and fix it. I think it also uncovers some deeper behaviors and characteristics in the organization by just being open about what we're not doing well and owning that and recognizing it. If I think in terms of this project, of the consent process, having worked at this organization for 25 years as a nurse, I always wondered, why am I the one doing the informed consent? This doesn't seem right. And then I got into patient safety and understood the compliance and regulatory component a little bit more, and it made less sense then. I think, you know, somebody finally saying we need to do something about this as a team of clinicians and staff really made the difference.
People have to feel safe, no question. As we wrap it up here, Dr. Roski, where does clinical optimization go next?
The consent project is on the downslope. It's meant to be a finite thing. You rework it and then it is implemented. But there's that long list of great ideas. So we have this great partnership where Sarah and Sue continue to take the work group into what is the next thing. And then the next area they are working on tackling is what happens with nursing and provider communication on rounds, which is an enormous undertaking, but so incredibly important for how our patients are involved in their care and how we have avoidance of errors and a clear communication of what the care plan will look like. And then there's the efficiency of how you have a consistent method of communicating and making sure the plan is clear. And Casey Oman, who's a nurse practitioner with palliative care, she is going to join the team as well because we're expanding into the surgical units and we get the great good fortune of the unit leader there, Kurt DeVos, being engaged in this work alongside Casey Hiltner, who's the unit leader on Med2. And there we are thinking this is a cycle. The work doesn't end. You might finish a project, but the term is continuous improvement, that we are in an infinite game against ourselves to always try to improve upon however our system is currently functioning, that there's always opportunity to do better. So I think the fact that this is ideally part of our standard work on our safety journey, that we will empower the people on the front lines to have the psychological safety to speak up, and then we will resource how to embed second order problem solving so that we can make a better system and a safer and more efficient care environment for our patients.